start with a question. Not a Bible question, just a general everyday trivia question. What is the motto of the Cub Scout movement? Be prepared. Some of us were scouts in our misspent youth. Be prepared. In this, we're looking at verses 13 to 16 here. But in verse 13, Peter calls the Christians that he's writing to be prepared. It's like he's saying, roll up your sleeves, or rather, roll up the sleeves of your mind. It's in some older translations, it literally says, and this is a direct translation from the Greek, gird up the loins of your mind. Because of course people in those days, they would have, you know, flowing robe, toga or a tunic. If you wanted to go somewhere, be prepared for action, you would sort of have to fasten your belt, gird up your loins, and then you'd be ready, fit for the fight. And he tells them, not just sort of put on the spiritual armour, he says, gird up the loins of your mind. He's asking us, and I read this in my study Bible, to prepare for vigorous and sustained spiritual exertion. Be prepared in your mind. Knowing the amazing work that God has done in us, that Peter talks about in the start of this letter, that we've just sung about in that wonderful hymn, are we prepared to live properly in the world, the messed up world that we're living in? We've got three ways of making sure then that we are prepared. There are just three directions. If you're thinking of Cub Scouts, imagine you're trying to get your Pathfinder badge, got your compass out here. Let's find three directions to look in to make sure that we are prepared in our minds for the life that we are called to as Christians. Firstly then, and we're looking at the second half of verse 13 here, look forward. Look forward, he says, therefore with minds that are alert and fully sober, set your hope on the grace to be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. One of the most powerful motives for proper biblical Christian living is remembering the wonderful promises that we look forward to, of what will be revealed, of what will be brought to you when Jesus Christ is revealed at his coming. This letter is pointing to that future hope, the day that no one knows. If anyone says they know, they are lying. We don't know when. We just know it's coming. It's down the road a ways. And it is guaranteed. Just because no one knows when doesn't mean that it's any less certain to come. The whole Bible, we looked at Genesis this morning, the whole Bible has been pointing forward to this moment, the moment of consummation, when Jesus Christ will return for his elect. That's the word Peter used for Christians, wasn't it? To God's elect, to the ones God foreknew and chose before he created the world. Is there any doubt that Jesus would leave his people on earth and forget about them? Look forward to what is coming. Look forward to who is coming. And if you keep that in mind, if you're looking forward at the future that the Bible has promised, whether it's one that we're going to see in our lifetime or if it's one that you'll see from the other side as you come with Christ, descending from the clouds, as it says in 1 Thessalonians, that hope should change the way we live. Are we living with this future hope in mind, or are we just living for this life? What motivates you when you plan your day, when you plan your life, when you plan how you use your money? Do you have this future hope in mind? Or is everything you do just sort of scrabbling to get by day to day, to keep a roof over your head, to keep yourself fed, to keep clothes on your back? Not that these things aren't important. It's not fair to say that. But is that what you're living for? Is that what motivates you? Just today? Or are you always thinking, somewhere at the back of your mind, I need to live with an eye on tomorrow. I need to remember what is going to happen so that I can be prepared for that day. So that it won't catch me unawares when it comes. It won't catch me standing on the outside looking in. Think of the time of Noah and the ark. And we know from the New Testament that Noah was a preacher of righteousness. So if you ever see a version of the story where Noah kind of builds the ark and doesn't let anyone in and sort of smugly trying to keep everyone out, like, you know, that film that came out a few years ago, that's kind of what happens. He won't let anyone else on the ark. That is not what happened. He was preaching the gospel to people, saying, come onto the ark, you're all going to drown. And they ignored him. They said, what a silly thing, Noah. I want to make sure I get fed. I'm not going to help you build a boat in the desert. I care about today. Why would I want to be prepared for this made-up future? They, you know, put the grain in their storehouses, they built their homes, they had their families, as they had done from the creation, and they lost everything when the flood came. Are you living with one eye looking forward? This great hope, this guaranteed hope that will change how we live, that will transform our behaviour, that will see us conformed because we know what is going to be brought about in us. If you want to be prepared, look forward. The second direction, we can look at verse 14. As obedient children, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. We're in 1 Peter. If you want to find where we are, 1 Peter verses 13 to 16. So we've had two directions. We've been looking forward, and we're now looking backwards. This is in verse 14. Look backwards. Because if, as you read verse 14 there, you might think that it's about behaviour. This is what you should do and this is what you shouldn't do. But if you look at it carefully, I think you realise it's not so much about behaviour as it is about identity. I think this is easy to lose perhaps in this translation, which they put it, it's better English, but it's maybe not so helpful for understanding who this obedient children is. Look back, remember who you were before you were heard the call of Christ. Who were you? You lived in ignorance. You lived a futile way of life, handed down from the ancestors. That's who you were. That's what defined your behaviour. That's what's defined your response to the God who called you later. Because you see, this call has changed the identity of the people that Peter is writing to. That's who you were. You were children of ignorance. That's a better translation, really. It doesn't sound as good in English. But it's a more literal translation. Not as obedient children, but as children of obedience. It's not just saying, like a child ought to obey its parents, so you ought to obey God. It's saying, as a person who is a child of ignorance. You might say a child of perdition. A child of obedience. This is who you are now. Because you're a child of obedience, you should desire to obey your father. You should desire. It's who you are. Because there's still this internal threat. Last week, we looked at sort of the external threats trying to conform us to something other than the image of Christ. All the things in culture and the world around us. But there's an internal threat. These evil desires that even though our identity has changed, there's a hangover isn't it? You know, sometimes you can be cured of a disease and the disease stays in your body for the rest of your life even. It only takes the right set of circumstances for that disease to manifest itself again or to mutate and come back. It's the same with the sin nature in us, isn't it? We're a new creation in Christ. We're not children of ignorance. We're children of obedience. Our nature has been changed. Who we are, our identity is different. And yet, we still have these evil desires in us. We're not going to have them forever. If we're looking forward, we're looking forward to the time when those remaining disease particles will be removed from our system. And we will be like Christ fully. But until then, we have these evil desires in us, working up, stirring up within us, trying to turn us away from the obedience which feels so good. Because we're imitating our beloved Father. Realise who you are. Look backwards. See who you were before you were called. And realise the change that God has made in you. Temptation is so much easier to resist when you realise it is alien to who you are. When you feel some urge to lose your temper or to do this, that or the other that you know is forbidden by the law of God. It's so much easier to resist when you say, that's not who I am. That's not what I am in Christ. This is kind of an alien thing coming in trying to conform me to something I don't want to be anymore. Think of Joseph, when he was tempted with Potiphar's wife, and I have no doubt from the narrative, as we'll get to in Genesis in 100 years' time, or however long it takes me to get to chapter 39, but when Joseph was tempted with this powerful woman, who could have had him, or almost did get him killed, how did he respond? It was a question of identity. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He knew he was an Israelite. He knew he was a child of God. It was not part of his identity to give in to that temptation. He knew he was a well-esteemed servant. His identity was not in giving in and abusing the trust that had been placed in him. It is easier to resist when you know who you are. Look backwards. Remember what you were. Look forward. Remember what you will be. And finally, looking here at verses 15 and 16, look up. Just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do. For it is written, be holy because I am holy. You've got in your footnotes there. It's a popular quotation from Leviticus that Peter gives. Be holy because the Lord your God is holy. But the specific place that he's quoting from is in chapter 19, a chapter that is about all or for all God's people. So it's not just the Levites. He's quoting the book of the Levites, if you like, but it's not only the bit that applies to the Levites. It's a bit where all God's people are called to be like him because he is holy. It's his essential beings. You need to know, brothers and sisters, that Christians are not just God's slaves. You get that idea sometimes, don't you, when you talk to people and they kind of feel like, well, I mean, they always do this. There's something wrong with Christians. There's something just weird and defective in them that's caused them to turn to religion. Like, you know, they're inferior people who need an emotional crutch from religion, and so they turn to God and they've always kind of bowed down by guilt and misery, and we're sort of always fearfully looking to God and hoping that he won't just strike us down. That's not my experience of the Christian faith. I hope it's not yours. It's not the experience that Peter speaks of in this letter when he's calling to the called people to be holy because he who called you is holy. We can get the wrong idea about holiness. We might think that we need to be holy in order to get into heaven, that you need to sort of achieve a certain level, or else God's intrinsic, essential holiness will force us away, like a force field just pushing us away, that magnet, polar opposite, pushing us away. And that's true, really, isn't it? God is holy, and if we aren't also holy, then we won't be able to come near Him. We won't be able to get into heaven. We wouldn't want to be in heaven because we'd be terrified of meeting a holy God and bringing even the tiniest fragment of our sin into His perfect presence. We'd be burned up. But the wrong idea we get is when we think that we can work up the right level of holiness, that we suddenly get passed through the gates. When we, as you know, in the films and the TVs and the artwork, Peter's there at the Golden Gates and he's got a book, usually, of all the good deeds, and he says, "Oh, is your name here? You can come in, you can come in, you can't come in." It's not like that, is it? I mean, I don't think Peter's at the gates anyway. That's a mistaken idea. But we sort of have the idea, like, what is the right level to hit? What is the proper level of holiness? What is acceptable? There's only one way to be holy enough. That's to be made clean by the blood of the Lamb. To be given the righteousness of Christ. The full 100% divine holiness. To be given that. And then you're made worthy to enter into the presence of God. And you should, if you are holy, you will delight to be in the presence of God. Like cleaving to like. It's like you'll suddenly come home in a way that you've never done before. Where what is now the essential attribute of your new creation being finds its perfect source and can rejoice. Because the other alternative of forever trying to look at your own actions and say, well, this is mostly holy, will just bow you down with a burden of guilt that you can't bear. It will make you miserable and it will make you bitter towards the God who has called you. We're not supposed to feel bullied by God. That's not what holiness is. We need to look to God both as the source of our holiness through being united to Christ, through being joined to Christ, sort of added into Christ. And as we need to look to Him as the motive that is for motivating behaviour that is appropriate to the people He has made us. This is why if you want to be prepared, you need to look up. You need to look to your Holy Father. And you need to desire to be like Him because of who He is. Our holiness, our personal, practical holiness, which Peter's going to open up in the rest of this letter, as I recommend, if you get the chance, look through it. Think about the practical implications of personal holiness. What should it look like in how we deal with other Christians? What should it look like in how we deal with our friends and our neighbours and our family members? Well, you can find out in the rest of this letter. But just reflect on this command for a moment. Be holy because I am holy. And we might hear that with like the thunder of Sinai and the terror of the Old Testament and think, well, I'm never going to be that holy. You've misunderstood. You've not got the motive. You've not caught the fire for what this verse is trying to bring about in you. It's a call to participate in the divine nature. It's like, be like me so you can enjoy being in me. Like a kid going along to its father's workplace, you know, wanting to wear the uniform. I remember one American pastor talking about how his father was a builder. And he used to, when he was a little kid, he used to take him along to the building site and he had a little lunchbox, just like his dad, the He had a little toolkit that he got to take with him, and he got a little mini hard hat, the uniform, and he felt, I'm like my dad now. And he got to be there with his father. That's what this call to holiness is. Not a call to be miserable and terrified and burdened with the guilt of a holiness that you can't achieve, but a desire to be like the one who has called you, to be involved in his life, in his being, in who he is. You see, as that filters down through your life, how it will change your actions. You want to be like him, not out of fear, but out of love. As you're motivated to honour and please the Father who has saved you through Christ. Let me just give you this quote from John Calvin. He says, in bidding us to be holy like himself, the proportion is not that of equals. So he's not saying you will become God. That's not what he's saying. But we ought to advance in this direction as far as our condition will bear. There's a way to go, and we're not going to achieve it. But what a direction to be heading in. Is your mind prepared? Are your eyes looking forward, set on the true prize? Are you looking backward? Can you see the difference between the person you were and the person God has made you? Are you looking up? Are you continually looking to Him as the source of your holiness and seeking to imitate Him as a dearly loved child? And if you are a Christian, you are dearly loved. Some of us just celebrated the Lord's Supper. And we remember what it costs for God to make us His own. We were bought at a price. There was no higher price than could be paid than the Son of the living God. And yet He paid it gladly so that we all could be adopted and would have the right to cry, Abba, Father. We have a great hope. Let us live accordingly. We're going to sing our final hymn, number 723. All I once held dear, built my life upon. All this world reveres and wars to own. All I once thought gain, I have counted loss, spent and worthless now compared to this. And I love this chorus. Knowing you, Jesus, knowing you, there is no greater thing.